Hey, Big John, I see by the paper here that a scientist has just crossed a potato with a sponge.
Oh, yeah? Hey, that sounds great. How does it taste?
Terrible. But it sure holds a lot of gravy.
Seems like I heard that joke once before on our program.
What program is this?
And no school today with Big John and Sparky.
Oh, yeah. And I'm Sparky.
And that makes me Big John, I guess.
Okay, let's start.
Okay, let's start. What's on the agenda?
What's that, agenda?
Well, that's like what's on the roster, the schedule, or the menu.
Now you're talking my language, because I understand menus.
Yeah, you're always thinking about your stomach, huh?
Yeah. No, seriously, we have music to start, and the way you're talking about food and menus and everything, it really adds up.
To what?
To what the song by Sherry Lewis and her gang is all about. Because she asks, what would you like for dinner tonight?
Well, I'll tell her just about anything, but I wouldn't be interested in that sponge-potato combination you had there.
Okay, Sherry, you heard what the man said.
Can you sniff? What do you smell when you sniff? Mother's cooking dinner. That smells good. Say, have you thought about dinner yet? Lamb Chop and Charlie Horse want a lot of things for dinner. See if you can remember all the things that they want.
What would you like for dinner tonight? What would hit the spot? You know that you're welcome to most anything we got.
I'll have charcoal steak
with lots of gravy.
French fried onions too.
What would you like for dinner tonight? What would hit the spot? You know that you're welcome to most anything we got.
I'll have lamb and carrot
with potato.
Mix them in a stew.
I'll have charcoal steak
with lots of gravy.
French fried onions too.
What would you like for dinner tonight? What would hit the spot? You know that you're welcome to most anything we got.
I'll have watermelon,
chocolate cake,
peaches, but with snow.
I'll have lamb and carrot
with potato,
mix them in a stew.
I'll have charcoal steak
with lots of gravy,
french fried onions too.
What would you like for dinner tonight? What would hit the spot? You know that you're welcome to most anything we got.
I'll have anything,
but I'm so hungry,
I could eat a shoe.
What would you like for dinner tonight? What would hit the spot? You know that you're welcome to most anything we got. Most anything, you can have most anything we got.
Big John, I just thought of something. I haven't told you about the chapter I saw last week down at the Westwood Theater in our favorite serial movie, General Comet of the Universe Patrol. I didn't tell you about chapter 311, did I?
I don't believe you did, Sparky. Well, what was it about?
Well, it was entitled The Nothing Universe.
Oh, yes. I remember you advertised that. Well, let's see. The last chapter you told me about ended as Captain Jupiter was trying to get back to Earth. So he and General Comet and First Lieutenant E.M. Goldbrick and Second Lieutenant Cornwallis Fritters and Professor Nuclear could investigate the mysterious radio messages that were coming from outer space.
That is key record, Big John. Bigot, John. Are you a bigot?
Well, I hope not.
Yeah, I do too. But as you will recall, as they headed back to Earth so they could outfit 3 rocket ships for the expedition into the unknown and unexplored universe, beyond the universe in which they lived, their rocket ship suddenly started flying backwards. Well, it wasn't really flying backwards. It was being pulled backwards by some mysterious, irresistible magnetic force.
Yes, and as the chapter ended, they were just helpless to do anything about it, and it was a hopeless mess, huh?
Yeah, you said it. And just to show you how helpless the mess was, the news of what was happening to Captain Jupiter and party in their rocket ship traveled through the universe faster than the speed of light. As they went flying past the planet Neptune, which is the second last one in the universe, the people of Neptune waved at them as they went past. And then as Captain Jupiter's rocket ship sailed past Pluto, the last planet in the universe, the people on Pluto had big signs up all over their planet, and printed on the signs were the words, "Farewell forever, Captain Jupiter. It's been nice knowing you. Farewell forever."
Well, that's a hopeless mess, all right. And it looks like, as if, at long last, all is lost.
I hope not, but it sure looked like it. But, John, after their rocket ship flew past the planet Pluto, it went even faster. So fast that everybody in the rocket ship was, you know, flattened up against the walls of the spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was just like they were stuck up against the wall. And Captain Jupiter said,
"Men, General Comet, sir,"
he said,
"if we don't stop this rocket ship, we're all going to be smashed flatter than half a pancake." And needless to say, that's pretty flat.
I should say it is pretty, because half a pancake is flat enough, but half of a pancake, that's a quarter of a pancake. Now, that's really, really flat. Okay, proceed.
Well, as the needle on the speedometer moved to the number 100,000, which meant the rocket ship was flying 100,000 miles a minute, it suddenly went boing, and it broke. And Captain Jupiter and General Comet and Cornwallis Fritters, E.M. Goldbrick and Professor Nuclear turned purple as they were squashed even flatter against the wall of the spaceship.
Even flatter than half of a half a pancake?
They were so flat that you couldn't even shave them off the wall with a razor blade. And then, all of a sudden, Big John, all of a sudden...
Hey, what was that?
Well, the rocket ship stopped. Oh. And then...
And that, what was that?
Captain Jupiter and General Comet and E.M. Goldbrick, Cornwallis Fritters, and Professor Nuclear becoming unsquashed off the wall.
Oh.
They were all back to normal again.
Back to normal, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, good.
Yeah.
Of course, knowing this serial, I know that nothing wonderful ever happens unless somebody gets into a bad mess immediately after. So what happened?
Well, Captain Jupiter sort of sensed that something was up, so slowly and cautiously he made his way to a porthole to look outside. General Comet followed, and so did the rest of the guys with him. They looked outside, and boy, what they saw made their eyes get as big as sewer lids. They all gasped.
Yeah, I know. Don't tell me that was the five universe patrolmen gasping, I tell you, huh?
Yeah, and then Captain Jupiter turned and said,
well, General Sir, you two men, looks like we have landed on some sort of a snow-covered planet.
And then, Big John, it showed what they saw outside the rocket ship.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was it? What did they see?
Nothing. Nothing but white.
Nothing but white.
Yeah, everything was white, even the sky. The sky wasn't blue in this new universe like it is in ours. Everything was white, and it looked like you were looking at nothing. It looked like, well, something like it would probably look if you could get inside a big glass of milk.
Uh-huh.
And then Professor Nuclear said,
I don't like to disagree with so distinguished a man as you, Captain Jupiter, but this here is not snow out there. Look.
And he pointed toward the rocket ship door. Hey, John, white smoke that looked like fog was seeping in, and Captain Jupiter gasped, and he said,
Look, fog is seeping in through the airtight door.
And Professor Nuclear said,
Once again, I must disagree with you there, Captain. Out there is not fog. Unless I miss my guess, that is the air which the people who live on this here planet, if there are people, breathe. But to we men from the planet Earth, it is a deadly gas which will wipe us out in nothing flat if we breathe it into our lungs.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Just then, General Comet yelled for him to break out the gas masks. And Professor Nuclear said,
That won't do much good, General. The gas will just seep through the gas masks, just like it's seeping through the airtight door of this rocket ship.
Gas is getting to him, I guess.
Yeah, and as Captain Jupiter gasped and coughed, he turned green as he said,
Then all is lost, Professor. Do you think so?
Professor Nuclear managed to gasp,
Yeah, your point sure looks that way.
What?
Captain Jupiter looked up and he said,
Men, take off your universe patrol hats. This sure looks like the end of Professor Nuclear.
Oh.
The gas is getting him.
And then as he looked at Professor Nuclear's green face and purple whiskers, his head had turned purple, Big John, he said,
And it'll get us unless we can find out what he was going to say after he said, unless...
And with that, Big John, chapter 311 ended.
A real mess.
Yeah. And I can't wait to see what happens to that mess in chapter 312 this afternoon. But come on, let's stop messing around and get the party started so time goes by faster. Okay?
March time next, boys and girls. March time as Gilhooly Mahoney and his internationally famous leprechaun marching band come to front and center here in Maestro... For some reason or other, it just doesn't seem right to call a leprechaun maestro. All right, I don't know the Irish name for it, but Gilhooly Mahoney raises his baton and gets ready to lead this magnificent marching band in today's marching song. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Gilhooly Mahoney and the Boys of the Old Brigade. Now, our storyteller, the singing lady, Irene Wicker.
The Magic Fishbone by Charles Dickens. Once upon a time, long ago, in the land of make-believe, King Watkins the First and his queen had 19 little children. Some were twins, some were triplets, and Princess Alicia was the oldest. Our story begins on Alicia's 7th birthday, which nobody remembered. To feed and clothe 19 little children, King Watkins the First had to work very hard. So, right after breakfast, he popped his crown on his head and started out. But the queen stopped him. "Yoo-hoo, Majesty dear. Now, please, stop at Mr. Pickles, the fishmonger, on the corner. Ask him to send a small cut of salmon to the palace in good time for dinner."
"Yes, yes, yes. Small cut of salmon. Dinner. Fishmongers. Corner. Here we are. Mr. Pickles. Oh, yes.
Poor King Watkins the First. That salmon cost 39 pennies, and he had only 40. Sadly, he put his last penny back in his pocket.
"Dear, dear, one lone penny until payday. Shoes to buy, food to buy. Worry. Now what? Music in the city street. Where does it come from?"
"Tra-la-la-la-la-la. Tra-la-la-la-la-la-lee. The music is coming from me."
"You, with a silvery wand. Who might you be?"
"I might be most anyone, King Watkins the First, but I am the Princess Alicia's good fairy grandmarina. And today is her 7th birthday."
"Oh, yes. I had forgotten."
"I have not, King Watkins the First. And I have plans that you must help carry out. My birthday gift for the princess is the salmon bone, which will be left on her dinner plate. She is to dry it, rub it, polish it until it shines like mother of pearl. Then cherish it as her dearest treasure, which, of course, it will be. Now, listen carefully so that you may sing her this little song. It will explain everything. My love to dear little Princess Alicia, and say happy birthday does Grandmarina wish her. The fishbone, if you treasure it dearly, a magic present will prove quite chillily. That is, if dear little Princess Alicia will at the right moment cry out, 'Oh, I wish, a wish that will help save us all.'"
Good fairy, Grandmarina. I cannot sing, you know." Disappeared. Worry.
Poor King Watkins the First. He worried all day. He worried all the way home from the office and all through dinner. When he saw the fishbone on Princess Alicia's plate, he cleared his throat importantly.
"Alicia, my dear, your good fairy Grandmarina appeared today. She said she was giving you a magic present for your birthday. That fishbone on your plate."
"Papa, the fishbone is magic. Oh, how wonderful."
She said I was to sing a song that would explain everything, but I can't sing, Alicia."
"Try, Papa, please."
"Botheration, if she is so magic, why does she not sing it herself?" "There she is. Listen.
"My love, do dear little Princess Alicia, and say happy birthday does Grandmarina wish her. The fishbone, if you treasure it dearly, a magic present will prove quite chilly. That is, if dear little Princess Alicia will at the right moment cry out, 'Oh, I wish, a wish that will help save us all.'" "Oh, it's beautiful. I know what this song means, Papa. You do not understand because you are grown up. Only fairies and children understand magic songs. Just having the magic fishbone in my pocket will make everything easy. Wait and see, Papa.
Well, I can't wait now, Lisa. I have to go and add up all the bills, etc., etc. Worry, 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 worry.
King Watkins I went off to work at his books, good fairy Grand Maria appeared, waving her magic wand. Hello, my dear little Princess Alicia. Alicia, Alicia, you know what the song means, Alicia. Yes, good fairy Grand Marina. It means the right time to wish on the magic fishbone is after we have done everything we can to help ourselves and still need help to save us from some awful, terrible misfortune. You're right, my dear little Princess Alicia. Good health, happy life does your Grand Marina wish her. Do not wish until your 17th birthday. Something wonderful will happen if you wait till then. Something wonderful, she said.
Alicia. Alicia.
Mother. Oh, Mother, you're ill. But don't you worry. I know exactly what to do because the doctor told me.
So Alicia helped nurse her mother back to health.
And she looked after all the younger children, day after day, year after year. At last, the night before her 17th birthday, she had not yet asked the magic fishbone for help. As she sat before the fire sewing, dreaming happily of tomorrow, King Watkins I stumbled into the room. Papa, you look ill.
Yes, Alicia, ill. And in debt as usual, but this time I have nothing with which to pay, not even my salary. Doctor says I must stop working for a year. I have sold everything but the palace. That must go soon. Oh, we shall have a roof over our heads. We can live in the royal stables, of course. But how am I to buy food and medicine?
I know. We all have done our best, Papa. And when our best is not enough, the time has come to wish on the magic fishbone. Dear good fairy Grand Marina, please forgive me. I must make the wish tonight.
Oh, I wish a wish that will help save us all.
Look, Papa, your salary. The golden coins are all coming down the chimney. And here is little good fairy Grand Marina, too.
Well, King Watkins I, I hope you understand at last why Alicia did not use the magic fishbone sooner.
Yes, yes, good fairy Grand Marina. Always before, we ourselves could do more. But this time, nothing.
Right, King Watkins I. From now on, until you are quite well, your salary will come 13 times a year instead of 12. And you shall live happily ever after. You too, Princess Alicia.
Indeed. Prince Sergeant Personio is waiting now at the church to marry you. So run along and be happy.
So Princess Alicia wed the prince. She became his wife. And they've lived happily ever since, quite free from care and strife. And that is the story of The Magic Fishbone by Charles Dickens.
You've been listening to The Singing Lady, Irene Wicker, and another of her famous fairy tales. This one was The Magic Fishbone, and I do hope you liked it.
Hello. I'm Shari Lewis. What's your name? Oh, how do you do?
Meow.
Oh, yes. This is my friend Lamb Chop.
Meow.
Lamb Chop, is there anything you'd like to say to everybody?
Well, I can't think of anything.
Oh, all right then.
Oh, I thought of something.
What?
Meow.
Shari, don't forget me.
Oh, sorry. This is my other friend, Charlie Horse.
How do you do? How do you do?
You know, Lamb Chop and Charlie Horse and I were wondering about you. Yeah, we wondered what you're like, and who you are, and how big you are. How big are you? Very big? Let me see. Stand up. Did you bump your head on the ceiling? No. Well, that's good. Can you imagine what it would be like to be that big? That's too big. I'd rather be small. Very small. About 1 inch tall, in fact.
Yeah, me too.
If I was only 1 inch tall, no one would see my face at all. I'd live in a hollow peanut shell. Wouldn't it be just swell? Up on a sparrow and away I'd fly. I'd land in a steeple and ring a bell. Wouldn't it be just swell?
Yeah, I've often wished that I could be as small as a pea in a pod.
Wouldn't it be odd if we could be just as small as a pea? On a lemon drop. Think of the stories we could tell. Wouldn't it be just swell?
You know, I've often wished that I could be as small as a pea in a pod.
Wouldn't it be odd if we could be just as small as a pea?
I'd live and live and never stop
if we could float on a lemon drop. Think of the stories we could tell. Wouldn't it be? Wouldn't it be? Wouldn't it be just swell? Just swell.
Yeah.
Last week the girls had a bonus of one in inspection time, so today the boys will have to work extra harder to make up for it. Okay, Big John, it's time for inspection, so inspect away.
All right, but I just happened to glance at the clock, and I noticed we have very little time today because of our long feature story about Washington Irving's Legend of Sleepy Hollow. So I'm just going to look into the spyglass here, and Sparky, I'll nod to you, and you mark down the score, and then we'll figure it out and see who wins today, the boys or the girls. All right, I'm checking for cleanliness first. That would be face, hands, and are you well washed? Well groomed, too? What does grooming include? Well, it includes your hair looking nice, being clean and brushed, in order, well dressed, I would say, and your clothes being somewhat neat, at least clean. And your shoes, yes, clean, shined wherever possible. Let's see a big smile here about the toothbrushes. Okay, that looks good, and I'm taking a quick look at your room. Mm-hmm. Right. I see. Okay, Sparky, I'll take a score now if you're ready to add things up.
All right, let's see. Well, the boys start with a 91.
91, okay, and then what?
And to that we add 1.
92.
And then 2 more.
That's 94.
And then here's another one for the boys.
Okay, that's 95.
And I believe I've got one more here.
That came in handy. That'd be 96.
And that's all.
Oh, well, it came in handy. All right, 96 for the boys.
Right. Okay, we go on to the girls.
Okay.
They have 91 to start, plus 1.
Uh-huh, 91 plus 1 is 92.
Plus 2.
93, 94.
Plus 1.
95.
And plus 2.
96, 97.
And that's one more than the boys, 96.
That's right.
So we make the girls winner by 1 point. Last week they had a bonus point, so that puts them 2 ahead. 2 ahead for next week. You know, I'm just getting so that the girls win so much here, I don't even get excited about it anymore. Okay, the girls have 2 points for bonus as they go into next week's inspection time. Congratulations, girls.
Our feature story today brings you the American classic by Washington Irving. We're going to dramatize The Legend of Sleepy Hollow.
In the bosom of one of those spacious coves which indent the eastern shore of the Hudson River, there lies a small village known by the name of Tarrytown. And not far from this place, there's a little valley, one of the quietest places in the whole world, called Sleepy Hollow. A drowsy, dreamy influence seems to hang over the land. Some say that the place was bewitched. And indeed, the people there descendants of early Dutch settlers, are given to all kinds of marvelous beliefs, are subject to trances and visions, and frequently see strange sights and hear music and voices in the air. The whole neighborhood abounds with local tales, haunted spots, and twilight superstitions. The dominant spirit, however, that haunts this enchanted region and seems to be commander-in-chief of all the powers of the air is the apparition of a figure on horseback without a head. Some folks say
it's the ghost of a Hessian trooper. His head was carried away by a cannonball during one of the battles of the Revolutionary War. Oh, I've seen him, I tell you, hurrying along in the gloom of night as if on the wings of the wind. I warrant he's out searching for his head. Last time I saw him, he was going fast as the wind, rushing, I reckon, to get back to the graveyard at the church before daybreak. We call him the Headless Horseman of Sleepy Hollow.
Now, there lived a long time ago in Sleepy Hollow a worthy fellow named Ichabod Crane. He sojourned there for the purpose of instructing the children of Sleepy Hollow. He was tall, but exceedingly lank, with narrow shoulders, long arms and legs, hands that dangled a mile out of his sleeves, feet that might have served for shovels, and his whole frame most loosely hung together. His head was small and flat atop, with huge ears, large green glassy eyes, and a long snipe nose, so that it looked like a weathercock upon his spindle neck to tell which way the wind blew. He was a conscientious teacher, but the revenue arising from his school was small, scarcely sufficient to furnish him with daily bread, for he was a huge eater. However, to add to his income, he became the singing master of the neighborhood, too, and instructed the young folks in singing psalms, and he picked up many a bright shilling this way. Now, the schoolmaster is generally a man of some importance in the female circle of a rural community, so Ichabod was happy in the smiles of all the country damsels. His appearance was always greeted with satisfaction, for he was esteemed as a man of great knowledge, for he had read several books straight through, and was a perfect master of Cotton Mather's book, History of New England Witchcraft, in which, by the way, he most firmly believed. In fact, his appetite for superstitious tales and his powers of digesting them were equally extraordinary. No tale was too gross or monstrous for his capacious appetite. One of his sources of fearful pleasure was to pass long winter evenings with the old Dutch wives and listen to their marvelous tales of ghosts and goblins and haunted places, and particularly of the Headless Horseman of Sleepy Hollow. At the end of such an evening, he would be warned.
Now mind your step, Ichabod Crane, and get yourself home quick.
But if there was pleasure in hearing these tales, it was dearly purchased by the terrors of his subsequent walk homeward. What fearful shapes and shadows beset his path. Oh, those shrubs covered with snow like a sheeted specter. How often did he shrink at the sound of his own step on the frosty crust beneath his feet. How he dreaded to look over his shoulder. Often he was thrown into complete dismay by some rushing blast howling among the trees, thinking it was the galloping headless horse. All these, however, were mere terrors of the night. Daylight put an end to all these evils. And Ichabod would have passed a pleasant life in spite of the devil and all his works if his path had not been crossed by a being that causes more perplexity to mortal man than ghosts and goblins and the whole race of witches put together. And that was a woman. Among the musical disciples who assembled one evening each week to receive his instructions in psalm singing was the daughter and only child of a wealthy Dutch farmer. Her name was Katrina Van Tassel. She was a blooming lass of 18, plump as a partridge, ripe and melting and rosy-cheeked as one of her father's peaches, and universally famed not merely for her beauty, but her vast expectations. She was also a bit of a coquette. Ichabod Crane had a soft and foolish heart toward the female sex, and it is not to be wondered at that so tempting a morsel soon found favor in his eyes, more especially after he visited her in her paternal mansion and saw the large degree of abundance that surrounded her. From the moment Ichabod laid eyes upon these regions of delight, the peace of his mind was at an end, and his only study was how to gain the affections of old Van Tassel's lovely daughter and heiress. In this enterprise, however, he had real difficulties. The most formidable of these was a burly, roaring, roistering blade by the name of Brom Van Brunt, the hero of the country round, which rang with his feats of strength and hardihood. Brom was broad-shouldered, with short, curly black hair, and a bluff but not unpleasant countenance. From his size and strength, he had received the nickname of Brom Bones. He was always ready for a fight or a frolic, but on the whole, had more mischief than ill will in his composition. Sometimes he and three or four boon companions would ride wildly past the farmhouses at night, and some old dame, startled out of her sleep, would angrily exclaim,
"Hey, there goes that wild Brom Bones and his gang! They ought to be put in the stocks!"
And when any madcap prank or rustic brawl occurred in the vicinity, someone was sure to say,
"Brom Bones is at the bottom of it, you can be sure."
Now, for some time, Brom Bones had singled out the blooming Katrina for the object of his uncouth gallantries. And though his amorous toyings were something like the gentle caresses and endearments of a bear, yet it was whispered about that Katrina did not altogether discourage his hopes. Such was the formidable rival with whom Ichabod Crane had to contend. To have taken the field openly against his rival would have been madness for Ichabod, because Brom was not a man to be thwarted in his love affairs. Ichabod, therefore, made his advances to the desirable young lady in a quiet manner. Under cover of his character of singing master, he made frequent visits to Katrina. From the moment Ichabod began to press his suit with her, the interests of Brom Bones declined. His horse was no longer tied at Katrina's door on Sunday nights, as it had been, and a deadly feud gradually arose between him and the schoolmaster of Sleepy Hollow. And then one fine autumn afternoon, Ichabod was invited to attend a merrymaking, or a quilting frolic, to be held that evening at Katrina Van Tassel's. Ichabod turned his school loose an hour before the usual time. He spent at least half an hour brushing his best and only suit, and that he might make his appearance before his mistress in the true style of a cavalier, he borrowed a horse from the farmer with whom he lived. It was a gaunt, shaggy animal who possessed but one good eye, a broken-down plow horse named Gunpowder. And thus gallantly mounted, Ichabod issued forth like a knight-errant in quest of adventure.
Here, Gunpowder! Here!
Toward evening, Ichabod arrived at his destination. The sumptuous Van Tassel mansion was thronged with old farmers, their wives and children, lads and lasses in festive air, and the hero of the scene was Brom Bones, having come to the gathering on his favorite steed called Daredevil, a creature like himself, full of metal and mischief. But while the throng was singing his praise, his rival Ichabod danced off with the lady of his heart, who smiled graciously in reply to all his amorous oglings. Brom Bones, seeing this, and sorely smitten with love and jealousy, sat brooding by himself in one corner. Now, when the dance was at an end, Ichabod was attracted to a group of folks who, with old Van Tassel, were gossiping and telling tales of ghosts and apparitions. And the chief part of these dismal stories turned upon the favorite specter of Sleepy Hollow, the headless horseman, who had been heard several times of late patrolling the country. In fact, one townsman, who did not at all believe in ghosts, said,
"But I tell you for true, I met the horseman returning from a trip into Sleepy Hollow. He came up behind me as I galloped along over hill and swamp until I reached the bridge, not far from the churchyard, when all of a sudden, the headless horseman turned into a skeleton and threw me into the brook and sprang away over the treetops with a clap of thunder."
And then Brom Bones threw into the group and matched this fantastic story with a marvelous adventure of his own.
"I was returning one night from a neighborhood village when I was overtaken by the headless horseman. But just as we came to the church bridge, he bolted and vanished in a flash of fire."
All of these tales sank deep in the mind of Ichabod Crane. When the party broke up, only Ichabod lingered behind to have a few private words with Katrina, fully convinced that he was now on the high road to success with her. Something, however, must have gone wrong, because now, when they were alone, Katrina was no longer responsive to his advances and seemed to want to be rid of him. So after no very great interval, he went forth from the house with an air quite desolate and chopfallen. Oh, these women. Was her encouragement of the poor pedagogue all a mere sham to secure the conquest of her rival? Heaven only knows, not I. Anyway, without looking to the right or left to notice the scene of rural wealth on which he had so often gloated, he went straight to the stable and with several hearty cuffs and kicks roused his steed most uncourteously.
Wake up there! Wake up there, I say, gunpowder! Wake up! Giddy up!
It was the very witching time of night that Ichabod, heavy-hearted and crestfallen, pursued his travel homeward along the sides of the lofty hills which rise above Tarrytown. In the dead hush of midnight, as he rode along on gunpowder, all the stories of ghosts and goblins that he had heard that evening now came crowding upon Ichabod's recollection. The night grew darker. As he approached a tree whose limbs were gnarled and fantastic in the darkness, he began to whistle. Then he thought with a start that his whistle was answered. It was but a blast sweeping through the dry branches. All at once he heard a groan. His teeth chattered and his knees smote against the sack. Then he saw that it was but the rubbing of one big bough upon another as they were swayed by the breeze. He passed the tree in safety, but new perils lay before him. He approached a rude bridge of logs spanning a small brook. The stream had always been considered haunted. As he approached it, his heart began to thump. He summoned up, however, all his resolution, gave his horse half a score of kicks in the ribs, and attempted to dash briskly across the bridge. But instead of starting forward, the perverse old animal made a lateral movement and ran broadside against the fence. Ichabod, in fear, jerked the reins on the other side and kicked lustily with his other foot. It was all in vain. His steed plunged to the opposite side of the road into a thicket of brambles and alder bushes. Just at this moment, a sound caught the sensitive ear of Ichabod. In the dark shadow of the grove, on the margin of the brook, he beheld something huge, misshapen, black, and towering. It stirred not, but seemed gathered up in the gloom like some gigantic monster, ready to spring upon the traveler. Ichabod cried out, "Who are you?" He received no reply. Ichabod's hair stood on end with terror. Just then, the shadowy object bounded into the middle of the road. But the night was dark. The form of the figure could be seen. He appeared to be a horseman of large dimensions, mounted on a black horse of powerful frame. Now he came alongside Gunpowder and jogged along beside him. Ichabod quickened his speed. The stranger quickened his horse to an equal pace. Ichabod pulled up and fell into a walk. The other did the same. Ichabod's heart began to sink within him. He tried to sing, but could not utter a sound. And then, on mounting a piece of rising ground, which brought the figure of his fellow traveler in relief against the sky, Ichabod was horror-struck. The figure was headless. But Ichabod's horror was still more increased on observing that the head, which should have rested on the figure's shoulders, was carried before him on the pommel of the saddle. Ichabod's terror rose to desperation. He rained a shower of kicks and blows upon Gunpowder, hoping by a sudden movement to give his companion the slip. But the specter started full jump with him, and they dashed through thick and thin, stones flying and sparks flashing at every bound. Now they reached the road that turns off the Sleepy Hollow, but Gunpowder, who seemed possessed with a demon, made an opposite turn and plunged headlong downhill to the left. The goblin was hard on his haunches, and Ichabod had much to do to maintain his seat. The church now loomed ahead. Before it, the bridge, the place he recollected where Brom Bones' ghostly competitor had disappeared. Ichabod said to himself, "If I can reach that bridge, I'm safe." Then old Gunpowder sprang upon the bridge and gained the opposite side. But at that very moment, he heard the black steed panting and blowing close behind him, and he felt its hot breath upon him. Ichabod quickly cast a look behind, just in time to see the goblin rise in his stirrups and with a fierce motion hurl his head at him. Ichabod endeavored to dodge the horrible missile, but too late. It encountered his cranium with a tremendous crash. And he was tumbled headlong into the dust, while Gunpowder, the black steed, and the goblin rider passed by like a whirlwind. The next morning, the old horse was found without his saddle and with the bridle under his feet, soberly cropping the grass at his master's gate. Ichabod did not make his appearance at breakfast. The dinner hour came, but no Ichabod. The boys assembled at the schoolhouse, but no schoolmaster. An inquiry was set afoot, and after diligent investigation, the searchers at last came upon his traces. In one part of the road leading to the church, his saddle was found trampled in the dirt. Beyond, on the bank of the brook where the water ran deep and black, they found the hat of the unfortunate Ichabod Crane, and close beside it, a shattered pumpkin. The brook was searched, but the body of the schoolmaster was not to be discovered. The mysterious event caused much speculation at the church on the following Sunday. The townsfolk shook their heads and came to the conclusion that Ichabod had been carried off by the headless horseman. It is true that an old farmer who had been down to New York on a visit several years later brought home the intelligence that Ichabod Crane was still alive, that he had left the neighborhood partly through fear of the goblin and of the man from whom he had borrowed his horse, and partly in mortification at having been suddenly dismissed by the heiress, Katrina Van Tassel, that he had changed his quarters to a distant part of the country, had kept school and studied law at the same time, had been admitted to the bar, turned politician, electioneered, written for the newspapers, and finally had been made a justice of the court. Brom Bones, who shortly after his rival's disappearance conducted the blooming Katrina in triumph to the altar, was observed to look exceedingly knowing whenever the story of Ichabod was related, and always burst into a hearty laugh at the mention of the pumpkin, which led some to suspect that he knew more about the matter than he chose to tell. The old country wives, however, who are the best judges of these matters, maintain to this day that Ichabod was spirited away by supernatural means. And it is a favorite story often told about the neighborhood round the winter evening fire. The bridge became more than ever an object of superstitious awe. The schoolhouse soon fell to decay and was reported to be haunted by the ghosts of the unfortunate pedagogue. And the plowboy loitering homeward of a still summer evening has often fancied his voice at a distance, chanting a melancholy psalm tune among the tranquil solitudes of Sleepy Hollow.
Our feature story today, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow by Washington Irving. Now then, Sparky, do you have something of a preview for next week?
Next week's feature story is going to be a big surprise.
You mean it's a secret?
Well, not exactly.
Well, then tell me what it is.
I can't.
Then it must be a secret.
Well, look, I'd tell you if I knew.
Oh, then you don't know yourself, huh?
No, that's why I said next week's feature story would be a surprise.
Even for you, huh?
Right, even for me.
All right, folks, be sure to tune in next week for the big surprise. Until we meet again, this is Big John speaking on behalf of myself and Sparky, saying from both of us to all of you the best of everything that's good, and may all your good dreams